won approval for U.S. assistance in training a Pakistani special forces team for an operation against bin Laden. Then, in October 1999, Sharif was deposed by General Pervez Musharraf, and the plan was terminated. At first, the Clinton administration hoped that Musharraf's coup might create an opening for action on bin Laden. A career military officer, Musharraf was thought to have the political strength to confront and influence the Pakistani military intelligence service, which supported the Taliban. Berger speculated that the new government might use bin Laden to buy concessions from Washington, but neither side ever developed such an initiative. By late 1999, more than a year after the embassy bombings, diplomacy with Pakistan, like the efforts with the Taliban, had, according to Undersecretary of State Thomas Pickering, borne little fruit. Section 4.4. Covert Action. As part of the response to the embassy bombings, President Clinton signed a memorandum of notification authorizing the CIA to let its tribal assets use force to capture bin Laden and his associates. CIA officers told the tribals that the plan to capture bin Laden, which had been turned off 3 months earlier, was back on. The memorandum also authorized the CIA to attack bin Laden in other ways. Also, an executive order froze financial holdings that could be linked to bin Laden. The counterterrorism staff at CIA thought it was gaining a better understanding of bin Laden and his network. In preparation for briefing the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence on September 2nd, Tenet was told that the intelligence community knew more about bin Laden's network than about any other top-tier terrorist organization. The CIA was using this knowledge to disrupt a number of bin Laden-associated cells. Working with Albanian authorities, CIA operatives had raided an al-Qaeda forgery operation and another terrorist cell in Tirana. These operations may have disrupted a planned attack on the U.S. Embassy in Tirana and did lead to the rendition of a number of al-Qaeda-related terrorist operatives. After the embassy bombings, there were arrests in Azerbaijan, Italy, and Britain. Several terrorists were sent to an Arab country. The CIA described working with FBI operatives to prevent a planned attack on the U.S. Embassy in Uganda, and a number of suspects were arrested. On September 16th, Abu Hajir, one of bin Laden's deputies in Sudan, and the head of his computer operations and weapons procurement, was arrested in Germany. He was the most important bin Laden lieutenant captured thus far. Clark commented to Berger with satisfaction that August and September had brought the greatest number of terrorist arrests in a short period of time that we've ever arranged and facilitated. Given the President's August memorandum of notification, the CIA had already been working on new plans for using the Afghan tribals to capture bin Laden. During September and October, the tribals claimed to have tried at least 4 times to ambush bin Laden. Senior CIA officials doubted whether any of these ambush attempts had actually occurred. But the tribals did seem to have success in reporting where bin Laden was. This information was more useful than it had been in the past. Since the August missile strikes, bin Laden had taken to moving his sleeping place frequently and unpredictably, and had added new bodyguards. Worst of all, al-Qaeda's senior leadership had stopped using a particular means of communication almost immediately after a leak to the Washington Times. This made it much more difficult for the National Security Agency to intercept his conversations. But since the tribal seemed to know where bin Laden was, or would be, an alternative to capturing bin Laden would be to mark his location and call in another round of missile strikes. On November 3rd, the small group met to discuss these problems, among other topics, preparing Director Tenet for a small group meeting in mid-November. The counter-terrorist center stressed, "At this point, we cannot predict when or if a capture operation will be executed by our assets." U.S. counterterrorism officials also worried about possible domestic attacks. Several intelligence reports, some of dubious sourcing, mentioned Washington as a possible target. On October 26th, Clark CSG took the unusual step of holding a meeting dedicated to trying to evaluate the threat of a terrorist attack in the United States by the Osama bin Laden network. The CSG members were urged to be as creative as possible in their thinking about preventing a bin Laden attack on U.S. territory. Participants noted that while the FBI had been given additional resources for such efforts, both it and the CIA were having problems exploiting leads by tracing U.S. telephone numbers and translating documents obtained in cell disruptions abroad. The Justice Department reported that the current guidelines from the Attorney General gave sufficient legal authority for domestic investigation and surveillance. Though intelligence gave no clear indication of what might be afoot, some intelligence reports mentioned chemical weapons, pointing toward work at a camp in southern Afghanistan called Derunta. On November 4, 1998, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York unsealed its indictment of bin Laden, charging him with conspiracy to attack U.S. defense installations. The indictment also charged that al-Qaeda had allied itself with Sudan, Iran, and Hezbollah. The original sealed indictment had added that al-Qaeda had reached an understanding with the government of Iraq that al-Qaeda would not work against that government, and that on particular projects specifically including weapons development, al-Qaeda would work cooperatively with the government of Iraq. This passage led Clark, who for years had read intelligence reports on Iraqi-Sudanese cooperation on chemical weapons, to speculate to Berger that a large Iraqi presence at chemical facilities in Khartoum was probably a direct result of the Iraq-al-Qaeda agreement. Clark added that VX precursor traces found near Al-Shifa were the exact formula used by Iraq. This language about al-Qaeda's understanding with Iraq had been dropped, however, when a superseding indictment was filed in November 1998. On Friday, December 4, 1998, the CIA included an article in the Presidential Daily Brief describing intelligence received from a friendly government about a threatened hijacking in the United States. This article was declassified at our request. The same day, Clark convened a meeting of his CSG to discuss both the hijacking concern and the anti-aircraft missile threat. To address the hijacking warning, the group agreed that New York airports should go to maximum security starting that weekend. They agreed to boost security at other East Coast airports. The CIA agreed to distribute versions of the report to the FBI and FAA, to pass to the New York Police Department and the airlines. The FAA issued a security directive on December 8th with specific requirements for more intensive air carrier screening of passengers and more oversight of the screening process at all three New York City airports. The intelligence community could learn little about the source of the information. Later in December and again in early January 1999, more information arrived from the same source, reporting that the planned hijacking had been stalled because two of the operatives who were sketchily described had been arrested near Washington or New York. After investigation, the FBI could find no information to support the hijack threat, nor could it verify any arrests like those described in the report. The FAA alert at the New York area airports ended on January 31, 1999. On December 17th, the day after the United States and Britain began their Desert Fox bombing campaign against Iraq, the small group convened to discuss intelligence suggesting imminent bin Laden attacks on the U.S. embassies in Qatar and Ethiopia. The next day, Director Tenet sent a memo to the President, the Cabinet, and senior officials throughout the government describing reports that bin Laden planned to attack U.S. targets very soon, possibly over the next few days, before Ramadan celebrations began. Tenet said he was greatly concerned. With alarm sounding, members of the small group considered ideas about how to respond to or prevent such attacks. Generals Shelton and Zinni came up with military options. Special operations forces were later told that they might be ordered to attempt very high-risk in-and-out raids, either in Khartoum to capture a senior bin Laden operative, known as Abu Hafs, the Mauritanian, who appeared to be engineering some of the plots, or in Kandahar to capture bin Laden himself. Shelton told us that such operations are not risk-free, invoking the memory of the 1993 Black Hawk Down fiasco in Mogadishu. The CIA reported on December 18th that bin Laden might be traveling to Kandahar and could be targeted there with cruise missiles. Vessels with Tomahawk cruise missiles were on station in the Arabian Sea and could fire within a few hours of receiving target data. On December 20th, intelligence indicated bin Laden would be spending the night at the Haji Habash House, part of the governor's residence in Kandahar. The chief of the bin Laden unit, Mike, told us that he promptly briefed Tenet and his deputy, John Gordon. From the field, the CIA's Gary Schroen advised, "Hit him tonight. We may not get another chance." An urgent teleconference of principals was arranged. The principals considered a cruise missile strike to try to kill bin Laden. One issue they discussed was the potential collateral damage, the number of innocent bystanders who would be killed or wounded. General Zinni predicted a number well over 200 and was concerned about damage to a nearby mosque. The senior intelligence officer on the joint staff apparently made a different calculation, estimating half as much collateral damage and not predicting damage to the mosque. By the end of the meeting, the principals decided against recommending to the president that he order a strike. A few weeks later, in January 1999, Clark wrote that the principals had thought the intelligence only half reliable and worried about killing or injuring perhaps 300 people. Tenet said he remembered doubts about the reliability of the source and concerned about hitting the nearby mosque. Mike remembered Tenet telling him that the military was concerned that a few hours had passed since the last sighting of bin Laden, and that this persuaded everyone that the chance of failure was too great. Some lower-level officials were angry. Mike reported to Schroen that he'd been unable to sleep after this decision. "I'm sure we'll regret not acting last night," he wrote, criticizing the principals for worrying that some stray shrapnel might hit the Habash mosque and offend Muslims. He commented that they had not shown comparable sensitivity when deciding to bomb Muslims in Iraq. Their principals, he said, were obsessed with trying to get others, Saudis, Pakistanis, Afghan tribals, to do what we won't do. Schroen was disappointed, too. "We should have done it last night," he wrote. "We may well come to regret the decision not to go ahead." The Joint Staff's Deputy Director for Operations agreed, even though he told us that their later intelligence appeared to show that bin Laden had left his quarters before the strike would have occurred. "Missing bin Laden," he said, "would have caused us a hell of a lot of problem, but it was a shot we should have taken, and we would have had to pay the price." The principals began considering other, more aggressive covert alternatives using the tribals. CIA officers suggested that the tribals would prefer to try a raid rather than a roadside ambush, because they would have better control, it would be less dangerous, and it played more to their skills and experience. But everyone knew that if the tribals were to conduct such a raid, guns would be blazing. The current memorandum of notification instructed the CIA to capture bin Laden and to use lethal force only in self-defense. Work now began on a new memorandum that would give the tribals more latitude. The intention was to say that they could use lethal force if the attempted capture seemed impossible to complete successfully. Early drafts of this highly sensitive document emphasized that it authorized only a capture operation. The tribals were to be paid only if they captured bin Laden, not if they killed him. Officials throughout the government approved this draft. But on December 21st, the day after principals decided not to launch the cruise missile strike against Kandahar, the CIA's leaders urged strengthening the language to allow the tribals to be paid whether bin Laden was captured or killed. Berger and Tenet then worked together to take this line of thought even further. They finally agreed, as Berger reported to President Clinton, that an extraordinary step was necessary. The new memorandum would allow the killing of bin Laden if the CIA and the tribals judged that capture was not feasible, a judgment it already seemed clear they'd reached. The Justice Department lawyer who worked on the draft told us that what was envisioned was a group of tribals assaulting a location, leading to a shootout. Bin Laden and others would be captured if possible, but probably would be killed. The administration's position was that under the law of armed conflict, killing a person who posed an imminent threat to the United States would be an act of self-defense, not an assassination. On Christmas Eve, 1998, Berger sent a final draft to President Clinton with an explanatory memo. The president approved the document. Because the White House considered this operation highly sensitive, only a tiny number of people knew about this memorandum of notification. Berger arranged for the NSC's legal advisor to inform Albright, Cohen, Shelton, and Reno. None was allowed to keep a copy. Congressional leaders were briefed as required by law. Attorney General Janet Reno had sent a letter to the president expressing her concern. She warned of possible retaliation, including the targeting of U.S. officials. She did not pose any legal objection. A copy of the final document, along with the carefully crafted instructions that were to be sent to the tribals, was given to Tenet. A message from Tenet to CIA field agents directed them to communicate to the tribals the instructions authorized by the president. The United States preferred that bin Laden and his lieutenants be captured, but if a successful capture operation was not feasible, the tribals were permitted to kill them. The instructions added that the tribals must avoid killing others unnecessarily, and must not kill or abuse bin Laden or his lieutenants if they surrendered. Finally, the tribals would not be paid if this set of requirements was not met. The field officer passed these instructions to the tribals word for word, but he prefaced the directions with a message. "From the American president down to the average man in the street, we want him, bin Laden, stopped." If the tribals captured bin Laden, the officer assured them that he would receive a fair trial under U.S. law and be treated humanely. The CIA officer reported that the tribals said they fully understand the contents, implications, and the spirit of the message, and that their response was, "We will try our best to capture bin Laden alive and will have no intention of killing or harming him on purpose." The tribals explained that they wanted to prove that their standards of behavior were more civilized than those of bin Laden and his band of terrorists. In an additional note addressed to Schroen, the tribals noted that if they were to adopt bin Laden's ethics, we would have finished the job long before. But they'd been limited by their abilities and by our beliefs and laws we have to respect. Schroen and Mike were impressed by the tribals' reaction. Schroen cabled that the tribals were not in it for the money, but as an investment in the future of Afghanistan. Mike agreed that the tribals' reluctance to kill was not a showstopper. From our view, he wrote, that seems in character and fair enough. Policymakers in the Clinton administration, including the president and his national security advisor, told us that the president's intent regarding covert action against bin Laden was clear. He wanted him dead. This intent was never well communicated or understood within the CIA. Tenet told the commission that except in one specific case, the CIA was authorized to kill bin Laden only in the context of a capture operation. That case will be discussed later. CIA senior managers, operators, and lawyers confirmed this understanding. We always talked about how much easier it would have been to kill him, a former chief of the bin Laden unit said. In February 1999, another draft memorandum of notification went to President Clinton. It asked him to allow the CIA to give exactly the same guidance to the Northern Alliance as had just been given to the tribals. They could kill bin Laden if a successful capture operation was not feasible. On this occasion, however, President Clinton crossed out key language he'd approved in December and inserted more ambiguous language. No one we interviewed could shed light on why the president did this. President Clinton told the commission that he had no recollection of why he rewrote the language. Later, in 1999, when legal authority was needed for enlisting still other collaborators and for covering a wider set of contingencies, the lawyers returned to the language used in August 1998, which authorized force only in the context of a capture operation. Given the closely held character of the document approved in December 1998 and the subsequent return to the earlier language, it is possible to understand how the former White House officials and the CIA officials might disagree as to whether the CIA was ever authorized by the president to kill bin Laden. The dispute turned out to be somewhat academic, as the limits of available legal authority were not tested. Clark commented to Berger that despite expanded authority for CIA's sources to engage in direct action, they have shown no inclination to do so. He added that it was his impression that the CIA thought the tribals unlikely to act against bin Laden, and hence relying on them was unrealistic. Events seemed to bear him out, since the tribals did not stage an attack on bin Laden or his associates during 1999. The tribals remained active collectors of intelligence, however, providing good but not predictive information about bin Laden's whereabouts. The CIA also tried to improve its intelligence reporting on bin Laden by what Tenet's assistant director for collection, the indefatigable Charles Allen, called an all-out, all-agency, 7-days-a-week effort. The effort might have had an effect. On January 12, 1999, Clark wrote Berger that the CIA's confidence in the tribal's reporting had increased. It was now higher than it had been on December 20th. In February 1999, Allen proposed flying a U-2 mission over Afghanistan to build a baseline of intelligence outside the areas where the tribals had coverage. Clark was nervous about such a mission because he continued to fear that bin Laden might leave for someplace less accessible. He wrote Deputy National Security Advisor Donald Carrick that one reliable source reported bin Laden's having met with Iraqi officials who may have offered him asylum. Other intelligence sources said that some Taliban leaders, though not Mullah Omar, had urged bin Laden to go to Iraq. If bin Laden actually moved to Iraq, wrote Clark, his network would be at Saddam Hussein's service, and it would be virtually impossible to find him. Better to get bin Laden in Afghanistan, Clark declared. Berger suggested sending one U-2 flight, but Clark opposed even this. It would require Pakistani approval, he wrote, and Pakistan's intelligence service is in bed with bin Laden and would warn him that the United States was getting ready for a bombing campaign. Armed with that knowledge, old Wily Osama will likely boogie to Baghdad. Though told also by Bruce Rydell of the NSC staff that Saddam Hussein wanted bin Laden in Baghdad, Berger conditionally authorized his single U-2 flight. Allen, meanwhile, had found other ways of getting the information he wanted, so the U-2 flight never occurred. Section 4.5. Searching for Fresh Options. Boots on the Ground. Starting on the day the August 1998 strikes were launched, General Shelton had issued a planning order to prepare follow-on strikes and think beyond just using cruise missiles. The initial strikes had been called Operation Infinite Reach. The follow-on plans were given the codename Operation Infinite Resolve. At the time, any actual military action in Afghanistan would have been carried out by General Zinni's Central Command. This command was therefore the locus for most military planning. Zinni was even less enthusiastic than Cohen and Shelton about follow-on cruise missile strikes. He knew that the Tomahawks did not always hit their targets. After the August 20th strikes, President Clinton had had to call Pakistani Prime Minister Sharif to apologize for a wayward missile that had killed several people in a Pakistani village. Sharif had been understanding while commenting on American overkill. Zinni feared that bin Laden would in the future locate himself in cities where U.S. missiles could kill thousands of Afghans. He worried also lest Pakistani authorities not get adequate warning, think the missiles came from India, and do something that everyone would later regret. Discussing potential repercussions in the region of his military responsibilities, Zinni said, "It was easy to take the shot from Washington and walk away from it. We had to live there." Zinni's distinct preference would have been to build up counterterrorism capabilities in neighboring countries such as Uzbekistan. But he told us that he could not drum up much interest in or money for such a purpose from Washington, partly, he thought, because these countries had dictatorial governments. After the decision, in which fear of collateral damage was an important factor, not to use cruise missiles against Kandahar in December 1998, Shelton and officers in the Pentagon developed plans for using AC-130 gunships instead of cruise missile strikes. Designed specifically for the Special Forces, the version of the AC-130 known as Spooky can fly in fast or from high altitude, undetected by radar, guided to its zone by extraordinarily complex electronics. It is capable of rapidly firing precision-guided 25, 40, and 105-millimeter projectiles. Because this system could target more precisely than a salvo of cruise missiles, it had a much lower risk of causing collateral damage. After giving Clark a briefing and being encouraged to proceed, Shelton formally directed Zinni and General Peter Shoemaker, who headed the Special Operations Command, to develop plans for an AC-130 mission against bin Laden's headquarters and infrastructure in Afghanistan. The joint staff prepared a decision paper for deployment of the Special Operations aircraft. Though Berger and Clark continued to indicate interest in this option, the AC-130s were never deployed. Clark wrote at the time that Zinni opposed their use, and John Mayer, the Joint Staff's Deputy Director of Operations, agreed that this was Zinni's position. Zinni himself does not recall blocking the option. He told us that he understood the Special Operations Command had never thought the intelligence good enough to justify actually moving AC-130s into position. Shoemaker says, on the contrary, that he thought the AC-130 option feasible. The most likely explanation for the two generals' differing recollections is that both of them thought serious preparation for any such operations would require a long-term redeployment of special operations forces to the Middle East or South Asia. The AC-130s would need bases because the aircraft's unrefueled range was only a little over 2,000 miles. They needed search and rescue backup, which would have still less range. Thus, an AC-130 deployment had to be embedded in a wider political and military concept involving Pakistan or other neighboring countries to address issues relating to basing and overflight. No one ever put such an initiative on the table. Zinni therefore cautioned about simply ordering up AC-130 deployments for a quick strike. Shoemaker planned for what he saw as a practical strike option, and the underlying issues were not fully engaged. The Joint Staff Decision Paper was never turned into an interagency policy paper. The same was true for the option of using ground units from the Special Operations Command. Within the command, some officers, such as Shoemaker, wanted the mission of putting boots on the ground to get at bin Laden and al-Qaeda. At the same time, Special Operations was designated as a supporting command, not a supported command. That is, it supported a theater commander and did not prepare its own plans for dealing with al-Qaeda. Shoemaker proposed to Shelton and Cohen that Special Operations become a supported command, but the proposal was not adopted. Had it been accepted, he says, he would have taken on the al-Qaeda mission instead of deferring to Zinni. Lieutenant General William Boykin, the current Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and a founding member of Delta Force, told us that opportunities were missed because of an unwillingness to take risks and a lack of vision and understanding. President Clinton relied on the advice of General Shelton, who informed him that without intelligence on bin Laden's location, a commando raid's chance of failure was high. Shelton told President Clinton he would go forward with boots on the ground if the president ordered him to do so. However, he had to ensure that the president was completely aware of the large logistical problems inherent in a military operation. The special operations plans were apparently conceived as another quick strike option, an option to insert forces after the United States received actionable intelligence. President Clinton told the commission that if we had had really good intelligence about where Osama bin Laden was, I would have done it. Zinni and Shoemaker did make preparations for possible very high-risk in-and-out operations to capture or kill terrorists. Cohen told the commission that the notion of putting military personnel on the ground without some reasonable certitude that bin Laden was in a particular location would have resulted in the mission's failure and the loss of life in a fruitless effort. None of these officials was aware of the ambitious plan developed months earlier by lower-level defense officials. In our interviews, some military officers repeatedly invoked the analogy of Desert One and the failed 1980 hostage rescue mission in Iran. They were dubious about a quick-strike approach to using special operations forces, which they thought complicated and risky. Such efforts would have required bases in the region, but all the options were unappealing. Pro-Taliban elements of Pakistan's military might warn bin Laden or his associates of pending operations. With nearby basing options limited, an alternative was to fly ships in the Arabian Sea or from land bases in the Persian Gulf, as was done after 9/11. Such operations would then have to be supported from long distances, overflying the airspace of nations that might not have been supportive or aware of U.S. efforts. However, if these hurdles were addressed and if the military could then operate regularly in the region for a long period, perhaps clandestinely, it might attempt to gather intelligence and wait for an opportunity. One special operations commander said his view of actionable intelligence was that if you give me the action, I'll give you the intelligence. But this course would still be risky, in light both of the difficulties already mentioned and of the danger that the U.S. operations forces might fail disastrously. We've found no evidence that such a long-term political-military approach for using special operations forces in the region was proposed to or analyzed by the small group, even though such capability had been honed for at least a decade within the Defense Department. Therefore, the debate looked to some like bold proposals from civilians meeting hyper-caution from the military. Clark saw it this way. Of the military, he said to us, they were very, very, very reluctant. But from another perspective, poorly informed proposals for bold action were pitted against experienced professional judgment. That was how Secretary of Defense Cohen viewed it. He said to us, I would have to place my judgment call in terms of, do I believe that the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, former Commander of Special Forces Command, is in a better position to make a judgment on the feasibility of this than perhaps Mr. Clark? Beyond a large-scale political-military commitment to build up a covert or clandestine capability using American personnel on the ground, either military or CIA, there was still a larger option that could have been considered, invading Afghanistan itself. Every official we questioned about the possibility of an invasion of Afghanistan said that it was almost unthinkable, absent a provocation such as 9/11, because of poor prospects for cooperation from Pakistan and other nations, and because they believed the public would not support it. Cruise missiles were and would remain the only military option on the table. The Desert Camp, February 1999. Early in 1999, the CIA received reporting that bin Laden was spending much of his time at one of several camps in the Afghan desert south of Kandahar. At the beginning of February, bin Laden was reportedly located in the vicinity of the Sheikh Ali Camp, a desert hunting camp being used by visitors from a Gulf state. Public sources have stated that these visitors were from the United Arab Emirates. Reporting from the CIA's assets provided a detailed description of the hunting camp, including its size, location, resources, and security, as well as of bin Laden's smaller adjacent camp. Because this was not in an urban area, missiles launched against it would have less risk of causing collateral damage. On February 8th, the military began to ready itself for a possible strike. The next day, National Technical Intelligence confirmed the location and description of the larger camp and showed the nearby presence of an official aircraft of the United Arab Emirates. But the location of bin Laden's quarters could not be pinned down so precisely. The CIA did its best to answer a host of questions about the larger camp and its residents and about bin Laden's daily schedule and routines to support military contingency planning. According to reporting from the tribals, bin Laden regularly went from his adjacent camp to the larger camp where he visited the Emirates. The tribals expected him to be at the hunting camp for such a visit at least until mid-morning on February 11th. Clark wrote to Berger's deputy on February 10th that the military was then doing targeting work to hit the main camp with cruise missiles and should be in position to strike the following morning. Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert appears to have been briefed on the situation. No strike was launched. By February 12th, bin Laden had apparently moved on, and the immediate strike plans became moot. According to CIA and defense officials, policymakers were concerned about the danger that a strike would kill an Emirati prince or other senior officials who might be with bin Laden or close by. Clark told us the strike was called off after consultations with Director Tenet because the intelligence was dubious, and it seemed to Clark as if the CIA was presenting an option to attack America's best counterterrorism ally in the Gulf. The lead CIA official in the field, Gary Schroen, felt that the intelligence reporting in this case was very reliable. The bin Laden unit chief, Mike, agreed. Schroen believes today that this was a lost opportunity to kill bin Laden before 9/11. Even after bin Laden's departure from the area, CIA officers hoped he might return, seeing the camp as a magnet that could draw him for as long as it was still set up. The military maintained readiness for another strike opportunity. On March 7, 1999, Clark called a UAE official to express his concern about possible associations between Emirati officials and bin Laden. Clark later wrote in a memorandum of this conversation that the call had been approved at an interagency meeting and cleared with the CIA. When the former bin Laden unit chief found out about Clark's call, he questioned CIA officials who denied having given such a clearance. Imagery confirmed that less than a week after Clark's phone call, the camp was hurriedly dismantled and the site was deserted. CIA officers, including Deputy Director for Operations Pavitt, were irate. Mike thought the dismantling of the camp erased a possible site for targeting bin Laden. The United Arab Emirates was becoming both a valued counterterrorism ally of the United States and a persistent counterterrorism problem. From 1999 through early 2001, the United States and President Clinton personally pressed the UAE, one of the Taliban's only travel and financial outlets, to the outside world to break off its ties and enforce sanctions, especially those relating to flights to and from Afghanistan. These efforts achieved little before 9/11. In July 1999, UAE Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Hamdan bin Zayed, threatened to break relations with the Taliban over bin Laden. The Taliban did not take him seriously, however. Bin Zayed later told an American diplomat that the UAE valued its relations with the Taliban because the Afghan radicals offered a counterbalance to Iranian dangers in the region, but he also noted that the UAE did not want to upset the United States. Looking for new partners. Although not all CIA officers had lost faith in the tribal's capabilities, many judged them to be good reporters. Few believed they would carry out an ambush of bin Laden. The chief of the counter-terrorist center compared relying on the tribals to playing the lottery. He and his associates, supported by Clark, pressed for developing a partnership with the Northern Alliance, even though doing so might bring the United States squarely behind one side in Afghanistan's long-running civil war. The Northern Alliance was dominated by Tajiks and drew its strength mainly from the northern and eastern parts of Afghanistan. In contrast, Taliban members came principally from Afghanistan's most numerous ethnic group, the Pashtuns, who were concentrated in the southern part of the country, extending into the northwest frontier and Baluchistan provinces of Pakistan. Because of the Taliban's behavior and its association with Pakistan, the Northern Alliance had been able at various times to obtain assistance from Russia, Iran, and India. The alliance's leader was Afghanistan's most renowned military commander, Ahmad Shah Massoud. Reflective and charismatic, he'd been one of the true heroes of the war against the Soviets. But his bands had been charged with more than one massacre, and the Northern Alliance was widely thought to finance itself, in part through trade in heroin. Nor had Massoud shown much aptitude for governing except as a ruthless warlord. Nevertheless, Tenet told us Massoud seemed the most interesting possible new ally against bin Laden. In February 1999, Tenet sought President Clinton's authorization to enlist Massoud and his forces as partners. In response to this request, the President signed the Memorandum of Notification, whose language he personally altered. Tenet says he saw no significance in the President's changes. So far as he was concerned, it was the language of August 1998, expressing a preference for capture but accepting the possibility that bin Laden could not be brought out alive. "We were plowing the same ground," Tenet said. CIA officers described Massoud's reaction when he heard that the United States wanted him to capture and not kill bin Laden. One characterized Massoud's body language as a wince. Schroen recalled Massoud's response as, "You guys are crazy. You haven't changed a bit." In Schroen's opinion, the capture proviso inhibited Massoud and his forces from going after bin Laden, but did not completely stop them. The idea, however, was a long shot. Bin Laden's usual base of activity was near Kandahar, far from the front lines of Taliban operations against the Northern Alliance. Kandahar, May 1999. It was in Kandahar that perhaps the last and most likely the best opportunity arose for targeting bin Laden with cruise missiles before 9/11. In May 1999, CIA assets in Afghanistan reported on bin Laden's location in and around Kandahar over the course of 5 days and nights. The reporting was very detailed and came from several sources. If this intelligence was not actionable, working-level officials said at the time and today, it was hard for them to imagine how any intelligence on bin Laden in Afghanistan would meet the standard. Communications were good, and the cruise missiles were ready. "This was in our strike zone," a senior military official said. "It was a fat pitch, a home run. He expected the missiles to fly. When the decision came back that they should stand down, not shoot," the officer said, "we all just slumped." He told us he knew of no one at the Pentagon or the CIA who thought it was a bad gamble. Bin Laden should have been a dead man that night, he said. Working-level CIA officials agreed. While there was a conflicting intelligence report about Bin Laden's whereabouts, the experts discounted it. At the time, CIA working-level officials were told by their managers that the strikes were not ordered because the military doubted the intelligence and worried about collateral damage. Replying to a frustrated colleague in the field, the Bin Laden unit chief wrote, "Having a chance to get Bin Laden 3 times in 36 hours and foregoing the chance each time has made me a bit angry." The DCI finds himself alone at the table, with the other principals basically saying, "We'll go along with your decision, Mr. Director," and implicitly saying that the agency will hang alone if the attack doesn't get Bin Laden. But the military officer quoted earlier recalled that the Pentagon had been willing to act. He told us that Clark informed him and others that Tenet assessed the chance of the intelligence being accurate at 50-50. This officer believed that Tenet's assessment was the key to the decision. Tenet told us he does not remember any details about this episode except that the intelligence came from a single uncorroborated source and that there was a risk of collateral damage. The story is further complicated by Tenet's absence from the critical principals meeting on this strike. He was apparently out of town. His deputy, John Gordon, was representing the CIA. Gordon recalled having presented the intelligence in a positive light, with appropriate caveats, but stating that this intelligence was about as good as it could get. Berger remembered only that in all such cases, the call had been Tenet's. Berger felt sure that Tenet was eager to get Bin Laden. In his view, Tenet did his job responsibly. George would call and say, "We just don't have it," Berger said. The decision not to strike in May 1999 may now seem hard to understand. In fairness, we note 2 points. First, in December 1999, the principal's wariness about ordering a strike appears to have been vindicated. Bin Laden left his room unexpectedly, and if a strike had been ordered, he would not have been hit. Second, the administration and the CIA in particular was in the midst of intense scrutiny and criticism in May 1999 because faulty intelligence had just led the United States to mistakenly bomb the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the NATO war against Serbia. This episode may have made officials more cautious than might otherwise have been the case. From May 1999 until September 2001, policymakers did not again actively consider a missile strike against Bin Laden. The principals did give some further consideration in 1999 to more general strikes, reviving Clark's Delenda notion of hitting camps and infrastructure to disrupt al-Qaeda's organization. In the first months of 1999, the joint staff had developed broader target lists to undertake a focused campaign against the infrastructure of Bin Laden's network and to hit Taliban government sites as well. General Shelton told us that the Taliban targets were easier to hit and more substantial. Part of the context for considering broader strikes in the summer of 1999 was renewed worry about Bin Laden's ambitions to acquire weapons of mass destruction. In May and June, the U.S. government received a flurry of ominous reports, including more information about chemical weapons training or development at the Darunta camp and possible attempts to amass nuclear material at Herat. By late June, U.S. and other intelligence services had concluded that al-Qaeda was in pre-attack mode, perhaps again involving Abu Hafs, the Mauritanian. On June 25th, at Clark's request, Berger convened the small group in his office to discuss the alert. Bin Laden's WMD programs and his location should we preempt by attacking UBL facilities? Clark urged Berger to ask his colleagues. In his handwritten notes on the meeting paper, Berger jotted down the presence of 7 to 11 families in the Tarnak Farms facility, which could mean 60 to 65 casualties. Berger noted the possible slight impact on Bin Laden and added, "If he responds, we're blamed." The NSC staff raised the option of waiting until after a terrorist attack and then retaliating, including possible strikes on the Taliban. But Clark observed that Bin Laden would probably empty his camps after an attack. The military route seemed to have reached a dead end. In December 1999, Clark urged Berger to ask the principals to ask themselves, "Why have there been no real options lately for direct U.S. military action?" There are no notes recording whether the question was discussed or, if it was, how it was answered. Reports of possible attacks by Bin Laden kept coming in throughout 1999. They included a threat to blow up the FBI building in Washington, D.C. In September, the CSG reviewed a possible threat to a flight out of Los Angeles or New York. These warnings came amid dozens of others that flooded in. With military and diplomatic options practically exhausted by the summer of 1999, the U.S. government seemed to be back where it had been in the summer of 1998, relying on the CIA to find some other option. That picture also seemed discouraging. Several disruptions and renditions aimed against the broader al-Qaeda network had succeeded, but covert action efforts in Afghanistan had not been fruitful. In mid-1999, new leaders arrived at the Counter-Terrorist Center and the Bin Laden Unit. The new director of CTC replacing Jeff was Kofor Black. The new head of the section that included the Bin Laden Unit was Richard. Black, Richard, and their colleagues began working on a new operational strategy for attacking al-Qaeda. Their starting point was to get better intelligence, relying more on the CIA's own sources and less on the tribals. In July 1999, President Clinton authorized the CIA to work with several governments to capture Bin Laden and extended the scope of efforts to Bin Laden's principal lieutenants. The president reportedly also authorized a covert action under carefully limited circumstances, which, if successful, would have resulted in Bin Laden's death. Attorney General Janet Reno again expressed concerns on policy grounds. She was worried about the danger of retaliation. The CIA also developed a short-lived effort to work with a Pakistani team that we discussed earlier, and an initiative to work with Uzbekistan. The Uzbeks needed basic equipment and training. No action could be expected before March 2000 at the earliest. In the fall 1999, DCI 10 had unveiled the CIA's new Bin Laden strategy. It was called simply The Plan. The plan proposed continuing disruption and rendition operations worldwide. It announced a program for hiring and training better officers with counterterrorism skills, recruiting more assets, and trying to penetrate al-Qaeda's ranks. The plan aimed to close gaps in technical intelligence collection, signal, and imagery as well. In addition, the CIA would increase contacts with the Northern Alliance rebels fighting the Taliban. With the new operational strategy, the CIA evaluated its capture options. None scored high marks. The CIA had no confidence in the Pakistani effort. In the event that Bin Laden traveled to the Kandahar region in southern Afghanistan, the tribal network there was unlikely to attack a heavily guarded Bin Laden. The counter-terrorist center rated the chance of success at less than 10%. To the northwest, the Uzbeks might be ready for a cross-border sortie in 6 months. Their chance of success was also rated at less than 10%. In the northeast were Massoud's Northern Alliance forces, perhaps the CIA's best option. In late October, a group of officers from the Counter-Terrorist Center flew into the Panjshir Valley to meet with Massoud, a hazardous journey in rickety helicopters that would be repeated several times in the future. Massoud appeared committed to helping the United States collect intelligence on Bin Laden's activities and whereabouts, and agreed to try to capture him if the opportunity arose. The Bin Laden unit was satisfied that its reporting on Bin Laden would now have a second source, but it also knew that Massoud would act against Bin Laden only if his own interests and those of the United States intersected. By early December, the CIA rated this possibility at less than 15%. Finally, the CIA considered the possibility of putting U.S. personnel on the ground in Afghanistan. The CIA had been discussing this option with Special Operations Command and found enthusiasm on the working level, but reluctance at higher levels. CIA saw a 95% chance of Special Operations Command forces capturing Bin Laden if deployed, but less than a 5% chance of such a deployment. Sending CIA officers into Afghanistan was to be considered if the gain clearly outweighs the risk, but at this time no such gains presented themselves to warrant the risk. As mentioned earlier, such a protracted deployment of U.S. Special Operations forces into Afghanistan, perhaps as part of a team joined to a deployment of the CIA's own officers, would have required a major policy initiative, probably combined with efforts to secure the support of at least one or two neighboring countries, to make a long-term commitment, establish a durable presence on the ground, and be prepared to accept the associated risks and costs. Such a military plan was never developed for interagency consideration before 9/11. As 1999 came to a close, the CIA had a new strategic plan in place for capturing Bin Laden, but no option was rated as having more than a 15% chance of achieving that objective. Chapter 5. Al-Qaeda Aims at American Homeland. Section 5.1. Terrorist Entrepreneurs. By early 1999, Al-Qaeda was already a potent adversary of the United States. Bin Laden and his chief of operations, Abu Hafs al-Masri, also known as Muhammad Atif, occupied undisputed leadership positions atop al-Qaeda's organizational structure. Within this structure, al-Qaeda's worldwide terrorist operations relied heavily on the ideas and work of enterprising and strong-willed field commanders, who enjoyed considerable autonomy. To understand how the organization actually worked, and to introduce the origins of the 9/11 plot, we briefly examine three of these subordinate commanders: Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM, Ridwan Ismuddin, better known as Hambali, and Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri. We will devote the most attention to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the chief manager of the Plains operation. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. No one exemplifies the model of the terrorist entrepreneur more clearly than Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the principal architect of the 9/11 attacks. KSM followed a rather tortuous path to his eventual membership in Al-Qaeda. Highly educated and equally comfortable in a government office or a terrorist safe house, KSM applied his imagination, technical aptitude, and managerial skills to hatching and planning an extraordinary array of terrorist schemes. These ideas included conventional car bombing, political assassinations, aircraft bombing, hijacking, reservoir poisoning, and ultimately, the use of aircraft as missiles guided by suicide operatives. Like his nephew, Ramzi Youssef, 3 years KSM's junior, KSM grew up in Kuwait but traces his ethnic lineage to the Baluchistan region, straddling Iran and Pakistan. Raised in a religious family, KSM claims to have joined the Muslim Brotherhood at age 16 and to have become enamored of violent jihad at youth camps in the desert. In 1983, following his graduation from secondary education, KSM left Kuwait to enroll at Shawan College, a small Baptist school in Murfreesboro, North Carolina. After a semester at Shawan, KSM transferred to North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in Greensboro, which he attended with Youssef's brother, another future Al-Qaeda member. KSM earned a degree in mechanical engineering in December 1986. Although he apparently did not attract attention for extreme Islamist beliefs or activities while in the United States, KSM plunged into the anti-Soviet Afghan jihad soon after graduating from college. Visiting Pakistan for the first time in early 1997, he traveled to Peshawar, where his brother Zahid introduced him to the famous Afghan Mujahideen Abdul Rasul Sayef, head of the Hezbollah Ittehad el-Islami, or Islamic Union Party. Sayef became KSM's mentor and provided KSM with military training at Sayef's Sada camp. KSM claims he then fought the Soviets and remained at the front there for 3 months before being summoned to perform administrative duties for Abdullah Azam. KSM next took a job working for an electronics firm that catered to the communications needs of Afghan groups, where he learned about drills used to excavate caves in Afghanistan. Between 1988 and 1992, KSM helped run a non-governmental organization, or NGO, in Peshawar and Jalalabad. Sponsored by Sayef, it was designed to aid young Afghan Mujahideen. In 1992, KSM spent some time fighting alongside the Mujahideen in Bosnia and supporting that effort with financial donations. After returning briefly to Pakistan, he moved his family to Qatar, the suggestion to the former Minister of Islamic Affairs of Qatar, Sheikh Abdallah bin Khalid bin Hamad Al Thani. KSM took a position in Qatar as project engineer with the Qatari Ministry of Electricity and Water. Although he engaged in extensive international travel during his tenure at the ministry, much of it in furtherance of terrorist activity, KSM would hold his position there until early 1996, when he fled to Pakistan to avoid capture by U.S. authorities. KSM first came to the attention of U.S. law enforcement as a result of his cameo role in the World Trade Center bombing. According to KSM, he learned of Ramzi Youssef's intention to launch an attack inside the United States in 1991 or 92, when Youssef was receiving explosives training in Afghanistan. During the fall of 1992, while Youssef was building the bomb he would use in that attack, KSM and Youssef had numerous telephone conversations during which Youssef discussed his progress and sought additional funding. On November 3, 1992, KSM wired $660 from Qatar to the bank account of Youssef's co-conspirator, Mohammed Salameh. KSM does not appear to have contributed any more substantially to this operation. Youssef's instant notoriety as the mastermind of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing inspired KSM to become involved in planning attacks against the United States. By his own account, KSM's animus toward the United States stemmed not from his experiences there as a student, but rather from his violent disagreement with U.S. foreign policy favoring Israel. In 1994, KSM accompanied Youssef to the Philippines, and the two of them began planning what is now known as the Manila Air or Boyinka Plot, the intended bombing of 12 U.S. commercial jumbo jets over the Pacific during a two-day span. This marked the first time KSM took part in the actual planning of a terrorist operation. While sharing an apartment in Manila during the summer of 1994, he and Youssef acquired chemicals and other materials necessary to construct bombs and timers. They also cased target flights to Hong Kong and Seoul that would have onward legs to the United States. During this same period, KSM and USF also developed plans to assassinate President Clinton during his November 1994 trip to Manila and to bomb U.S.-bound cargo carriers by smuggling jackets containing nitrocellulose on board. KSM left the Philippines in September 1994 and met up with USF in Karachi following their casing flights. There they enlisted Wali Khan Amin Shah, also known as Usama Asmurai, in the Manila air plot. During the fall of 1994, USF returned to Manila and successfully tested the digital watch timer he'd invented, bombing a movie theater and a Philippine Airlines flight en route to Tokyo. The plot unraveled after the Philippine authorities discovered USF's bomb-making operation in Manila, but by that time, KSM was safely back at his government job in Qatar. USF attempted to follow through on the cargo carrier's plan, but he was arrested in Islamabad by Pakistani authorities on February 7, 1995, after an accomplice turned him in. KSM continued to travel among the worldwide jihadist community after USF's arrest, visiting the Sudan, Yemen, Malaysia, and Brazil in 1995. No clear evidence connects him to terrorist activities in those locations. While in Sudan, he reportedly failed in his attempt to meet with bin Laden. But KSM did see Atef, who gave him a contact in Brazil. In January 1996, well aware that U.S. authorities were chasing him, he left Qatar for good and fled to Afghanistan, where he renewed his relationship with Rasul Sayaf. Just as KSM was reestablishing himself in Afghanistan in mid-1996, bin Laden and his colleagues were also completing their migration from Sudan. Through Atef, KSM arranged a meeting with bin Laden in Tora Bora, a mountainous redoubt from the Afghan war days. At the meeting, KSM presented the al-Qaeda leader with a menu of ideas for terrorist operations. According to KSM, this meeting was the first time he'd seen bin Laden since 1989. Although they'd fought together in 1987, bin Laden and KSM did not yet enjoy an especially close working relationship. Indeed, KSM has acknowledged that bin Laden likely agreed to meet with him because of the renown of his nephew, Yusef. At the meeting, KSM briefed bin Laden and Atef on the First World Trade Center bombing, the Manila air plot, the cargo carrier's plan, and other activities pursued by KSM and his colleagues in the Philippines. KSM also presented a proposal for an operation that would involve training pilots who would crash planes into buildings in the United States. This proposal eventually would become the 9/11 operation. KSM knew that the successful staging of such an attack would require personnel, money, and logistical support that only an extensive and well-funded organization like al-Qaeda could provide. He thought the operation might appeal to bin Laden, who had a long record of denouncing the United States. From KSM's perspective, bin Laden was in the process of consolidating his new position in Afghanistan while hearing out others' ideas, and had not yet settled on an agenda for future anti-U.S. operations. At the meeting, bin Laden listened to KSM's ideas without much comment, but did ask KSM formally to join al-Qaeda and move his family to Afghanistan. KSM declined. He preferred to remain independent and retain the option of working with other Mujahideen groups still operating in Afghanistan, including the group led by his old mentor, Sayaf. Sayaf was close to Ahmed Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance. Therefore, working with him might be a problem for KSM because bin Laden was building ties to the rival Taliban. After meeting with bin Laden, KSM says he journeyed onward to India, Indonesia, and Malaysia, where he met with Jamaah Islamiyah's Hambali. Hambali was an Indonesian veteran of the Afghan War, looking to expand the jihad into Southeast Asia. In Iran, KSM rejoined his family and arranged to move them to Karachi, he claims to have relocated by January 1997. After settling his family in Karachi, KSM tried to join the Mujahid leader Ibn al-Khattab in Chechnya. Unable to travel through Azerbaijan, KSM returned to Karachi and then left to Afghanistan to renew contacts with bin Laden and his colleagues. Though KSM may not have been a member of al-Qaeda at this time, he admits traveling frequently between Pakistan and Afghanistan in 1997, and the first half of 1998 visiting bin Laden and cultivating relationships with his lieutenants, Atef and Saif al-Adl, by assisting them with computer and media projects. According to KSM, the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam marked a watershed in the evolution of the 9/11 plot. KSM claims these bombings convinced him that bin Laden was truly committed to attacking the United States. He continued to make himself useful, collecting news articles and helping other al-Qaeda members with their outdated computer equipment. Bin Laden, apparently at ATEF's urging, finally decided to give KSM the green light for the 9/11 operation sometime in late 1998 or early 1999. KSM then accepted Bin Laden's standing invitation to move to Kandahar and work directly with al-Qaeda. In addition to supervising the planning and preparations for the 9/11 operation, KSM worked with and eventually led al-Qaeda's media committee. But KSM states he refused to swear a formal oath of allegiance to Bin Laden, thereby retaining a last vestige of his cherished autonomy. At this point, late 1998 to early 1999, planning for the 9/11 operation began in earnest. Yet while the 9/11 project occupied the bulk of KSM's attention, he continued to consider other possibilities for terrorist attacks. For example, he sent al-Qaeda operative Isa al-Britani to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, to learn about the jihad in Southeast Asia from Hambali. Thereafter, KSM claims at Bin Laden's direction in early 2001, he sent Britani to the United States to case potential economic and Jewish targets in New York City. Furthermore, during the summer of 2001, KSM approached Bin Laden with the idea of recruiting a Saudi Arabian Air Force pilot to commandeer a Saudi fighter jet and attack the Israeli city of Eilat. Bin Laden reportedly liked this proposal, but he instructed KSM to concentrate on the 9/11 operation first. Similarly, KSM's proposals to ATEF around this time for attacks in Thailand, Singapore, Indonesia, and the Maldives were never executed, although Hambali's Jamaah Islamiyah operatives did some casing of possible targets. KSM appears to have been popular among the al-Qaeda rank and file. He was reportedly regarded as an effective leader, especially after the 9/11 attacks. Co-workers describe him as an intelligent, efficient, and even-tempered manager who approached his projects with a single-minded dedication that he expected his colleagues to share. Al-Qaeda associate Abu Zubaydah had expressed more qualified admiration for KSM's innate creativity, emphasizing instead his ability to incorporate the improvements suggested by others. Nashiri has been similarly measured, observing that although KSM floated many general ideas for attacks, he rarely conceived a specific operation himself. Perhaps these estimates reflect a touch of jealousy. In any case, KSM was plainly a capable coordinator, having had years to hone his skills and build relationships. Hambali. Al-Qaeda's success in fostering terrorism in Southeast Asia stems largely from its close relationship with Jamaah Islamiyah. In that relationship, Hambali became the key coordinator. Born and educated in Indonesia, Hambali moved to Malaysia in the early 1980s to find work. There, he claims to have become a follower of the Islamist extremist teachings of various clerics, including one named Abdullah Sunkar. Sunkar first inspired Hambali to share the vision of establishing a radical Islamist regime in Southeast Asia, then furthered Hambali's instruction in jihad by sending him to Afghanistan in 1986. After undergoing training at Rasul Sayyaf Sadegh camp, where KSM would later train, Hambali fought against the Soviets. He eventually returned to Malaysia after 18 months in Afghanistan. By 1998, Hambali would assume responsibility for the Malaysia-Singapore region, with Sunkar's newly formed terrorist organization, the JI. Also by 1998, Sunkar and JI spiritual leader Abu Bakr Bashir had accepted Bin Laden's offer to ally JI with al-Qaeda in waging war against Christians and Jews. Hambali met with KSM in Karachi to arrange for JI members to receive training in Afghanistan at al-Qaeda camps. In addition to his close working relationship with KSM, Hambali soon began dealing with ATIF as well. Al-Qaeda began funding JI's increasingly ambitious terrorist plans, which ATIF and KSM sought to expand. Under this arrangement, JI would perform the necessary casing activities and locate bomb-making materials and other supplies. Al-Qaeda would underwrite operations, provide bomb-making expertise, and deliver suicide operatives. The Al-Qaeda-JI partnership yielded a number of proposals that would marry Al-Qaeda's financial and technical strengths with JI's access to materials and local operatives. Here, Hambali played the critical role of coordinator as he distributed Al-Qaeda funds earmarked for the joint operations. In one especially notable example, ATEF turned to Hambali when Al-Qaeda needed a scientist to take over its biological weapons program. Hambali obliged by introducing a U.S.-educated JI member, Yazid Sulfat, to Ayman al-Zawahiri in Kandahar. In 2001, Sulfat would spend several months attempting to cultivate anthrax for al-Qaeda in a laboratory he helped set up near the Kandahar airport. Hambali did not originally orient JI's operations toward attacking the United States, but his involvement with al-Qaeda appears to have inspired him to pursue American targets. KSM, in his post-capture interrogations, has taken credit for this shift, claiming to have urged the JI operations chief to concentrate on attacks designed to hurt the U.S. economy. Hambali's newfound interest in striking against the United States manifested itself in a spate of terrorist plans. Fortunately, none came to fruition. In addition to staging actual terrorist attacks in partnership with al-Qaeda, Hambali and JI assisted al-Qaeda operatives passing through Kuala Lumpur. One important occasion was in December 1999 through January 2000. Hambali accommodated KSM's request to help several veterans whom KSM had just finished training in Karachi. They included Tawfiq bin Attash, also known as Khalad, who later would help bomb the USS Cole, and future 9/11 hijackers Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar. Hambali arranged lodging for them and helped them purchase airline tickets for their onward travel. Later that year, Hambali and his crew would provide accommodations and other assistance, including information on flight schools and help in acquiring ammonium nitrate for Zacharias Moussaoui, an al-Qaeda operative sent to Malaysia by ATEF and KSM. Hambali used bin Laden's Afghan facilities as a training ground for JI recruits. Though he had a close relationship with ATEF and KSM, he maintained JI's institutional independence from al-Qaeda. Hambali insists that he did not discuss operations with bin Laden or swear allegiance to him, having already given such a pledge of loyalty to Bashir. Sungar's successor is JI leader. Thus, like any powerful bureaucrat defending his domain, Hambali objected when al-Qaeda leadership tried to assign JI members to terrorist projects without notifying him. Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri. KSM and Hambali both decided to join forces with al-Qaeda because their terrorist aspirations required the money and manpower that only a robust organization like al-Qaeda could supply. On the other hand, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, the mastermind of the Cole bombing and the eventual head of al-Qaeda operations in the Arabian Peninsula, appears to have originally been recruited to his career as a terrorist by bin Laden himself. Having already participated in the Afghan jihad, Nashiri accompanied a group of some 30 mujahideen in pursuit of jihad in Tajikistan in 1996. When serious fighting failed to materialize, the group traveled to Jalalabad and encountered bin Laden, who'd recently returned from Sudan. Bin Laden addressed them at length, urging the group to join him in a jihad against the Americans. Although all were urged to swear loyalty to bin Laden, many, including Nashiri, found the notion distasteful and refused. After several days of indoctrination that included a barrage of news clippings and television documentaries, Nashiri left Afghanistan, first returning to his native Saudi Arabia and then visiting his home in Yemen. There, he says, the idea for his first terrorist operation took shape as he noticed many U.S. and other foreign ships plying the waters along the southwest coast of Yemen. Nashiri returned to Afghanistan, probably in 1997, primarily to check on relatives fighting there and also to learn about the Taliban. He again encountered bin Laden, still recruiting for the coming battle with the United States. Nashiri pursued a more conventional military jihad, joining the Taliban forces in their fight against Ahmed Massoud's Northern Alliance, and shuttling back and forth between the front and Kandahar, where he would see bin Laden and meet with other mujahideen. During this period, Nashiri also led a plot to smuggle 4 Russian-made anti-tank missiles into Saudi Arabia from Yemen in early 1998, and helped an embassy bombing operative obtain a Yemeni passport. At some point, Nashiri joined al-Qaeda. His cousin, Jihad Muhammad Ali al-Maki, also known as Azam, was a suicide bomber for the Nairobi attack. Nashiri traveled between Yemen and Afghanistan. In late 1998, Nashiri proposed mounting an attack against a U.S. vessel. Bin Laden approved. He directed Nashiri to start the planning and send operatives to Yemen, and he later provided money. Nashiri reported directly to bin Laden, the only other person who, according to Nashiri, knew all the details of the operation. When Nashiri had difficulty finding U.S. naval vessels to attack along the western coast of Yemen, bin Laden reportedly instructed him to case the port of Aden on the southern coast instead. The eventual result was an attempted attack on the USS the Sullivan in January 2000, and the successful attack in October 2000 on the USS Cole. Nashiri's success brought him instant status within al-Qaeda. He later was recognized as the chief of al-Qaeda operations in and around the Arabian Peninsula. While Nashiri continued to consult bin Laden on the planning of subsequent terrorist projects, he retained discretion in selecting operatives and devising attacks. In the 2 years between the Cole bombing and Nashiri's capture, he would supervise several more proposed operations for al-Qaeda. The October 6, 2002 bombing of the French tanker Limburg in the Gulf of Aden also was Nashiri's handiwork. Although bin Laden urged Nashiri to continue plotting strikes against U.S. interests in the Persian Gulf, Nashiri maintains that he actually delayed one of these projects because of security concerns. Those concerns, it seems, were well placed, as Nashiri's November 2002 capture in the United Arab Emirates finally ended his career as a terrorist. Section 5.2. The Planes Operation. According to KSM, he started to think about attacking the United States after Yousef returned to Pakistan following the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Like Yousef, KSM reasoned he could best influence U.S. policy by targeting the country's economy. KSM and Yousef reportedly brainstormed together about what drove the U.S. economy. New York, which KSM considered the economic capital of the United States,